Welcome back to From the Ground Up with Mark Weller. I'm Matt Rienzo here with my friend and co-host Mark Weller. What's up, Mark? How you doing?
I'm great. It's a beautiful time of year.
It is.
I'm getting in a good mood and a good spirit with the colder weather. I'm wearing a scarf. I'm wearing a jacket again, you know?
That's right.
We're away from the 97 degree heat with 111% humidity.
Well, speaking about heat, let's talk about, you know, we've got a lot of fun stuff going on.
Man, there's some
Grand Bahama and Napa. You know, we're working on some really world-class projects with equally world-class teams.
Yeah.
Including our guests today, who are a key part of our Six Senses Grand Bahama and Six Senses Napa Valley projects. They're beyond world-class. I'm going to use that line way too much, world-class. But they're beyond world-class in the design world. And if you're a residential or luxury space, if you're in that space, then you know about Olson Kundig. Olson Kundig is a collaborative global design practice whose work expands the context of built and natural landscapes. They do incredible, beautiful work, don't they, Mark?
Yes, amazing. I've always admired it and always wanted to, you know, get a chance to work with them. And it's kind of fulfilling like a lifelong goal of having an opportunity to be able to work directly with them on the design and then eventually the construction of these incredible residences and projects that we're building together.
No doubt. So let's get into it. We're excited to have owner and founder Tom Kundig, as well as principal and owner Kevin Kudo King of Olson Kundig on the show today. So without further ado, let's invite Tom and Kevin on the show.
Welcome to the show, Tom and Kevin. How are you both doing today?
No, we're doing great. And thank you, Matt and Mark. Real honor to talk to you guys and work with you on these fantastic projects.
Well, thank you. We're so excited to have Olson Kundig's team involved in both of our projects, which is really cool. And they're in such diverse places and spaces. One is in the Bahamas, in Grand Bahama, and the other is in Napa County, out there in Northern California. You know, some of these designs, magnificent homes, you do like similar projects like this all over the world. But the next, you know, 45 minutes, we're going to talk about, you know, a little bit where you draw your designs and your inspiration from, and then how you kind of, you know, because I see there's differences from location to location and kind of how you allocate that design inspiration into the locations that you actually work in.
Yeah. So really let's start there. Where do you draw your inspiration for these incredible designs that we see in all these amazing places?
Well, first of all, super thanks for the comment about our design work. But to be really clear, our design work is basically referencing the places that they're built. And I say this occasionally, we're not going to design anything that's more beautiful than the landscape and the places that we're privileged to build in. So our job is, and this is where Six Senses is just really brilliant, is that our job is to immerse the guest into that place and almost take the architecture in a way and make it part of the context. It almost disappears. That's an overstatement. I just want to, you know, make that clear. But ultimately, it's really about the guest experience in that landscape, if that makes sense. And so it's a heck of an honor to be able to work on very different climates, very different cultures, and begin to sort of understand those two places, those two cultures, and again, emerge in architecture that is very much about its place and about its time. And it's always an honor to work on any of these landscapes. I think Kevin should answer from his perspective also, because he's so deeply involved in both projects and both landscapes.
Well, I think the work that we do, as Tom has said, is about place. It's about the site. But, you know, it's about the kind of physical aspects of the site, but also sort of the non-physical aspects. You know, there's a vibe in the Caribbean at Grand Bahamas, a vibe there that we want to respond to and capture. It's a fun vibe. It's a low key one. I grew up in Hawaii, and it's completely different. Almost to the point of being surreal, in my opinion. But the other thing that keeps our work evolving is the clients we work for, and Weller's approach is a bold one. You have no fear. You're going after doing world-class stuff. You're going to put together the right teams, and you're going to keep pursuing that. And so the client and the site are really what gets us going. Beyond that, it's the craft and materiality and the builder and what gets built in the end. Yeah.
Great. And I've heard you both talk about the human-centered approach in some other interviews that you've done and conversations that we've had. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? You did talk a lot about place and the site and the landscape, and that's all incredible. And it makes total sense, having worked with you for a while, to hear it now philosophically as well. But talk a little bit about the human-centered part of it.
Well, that's a really good question. Because ultimately, architecture is about the human experience. Food, water, shelter, those are basic needs that we all need to make a place and protect ourselves, the refuge, the idea of prospect, super important to the way we as a species react and to a place and to a culture. And it's architecture ultimately is about that. It's about how do we wrap a building around us and protect us and in a sense open us to that surrounding and be able to modulate between those two experiences. And ultimately that's what architecture is about. It's about the human condition, a human scale. It's all about how we live and how we experience the place and culture.
No, that is amazing. And to think about it from that human scale. And I learned a lot about that when I was doing larger projects and starting to understand what's the experience on the ground. Because you can build huge buildings, but what is that person walking around actually experience? And I think that when you start building into environments that are naturally beautiful and naturally give you the sort of half of the beauty or three quarters of the beauty of what you're trying to create, naturally, these lower slung, built within the land, built to that scale, fit in so well. And what happens is they actually almost disappear into the landscape. And I've noticed that with you all in many of your buildings. You wouldn't notice them from too far away. It's when you get up close, you start to notice how well integrated into the landscape they are. How do you think about that? Like, how do you think about not, I'll give you an example of what bothers me about things being built today. You know, I go over to one of my favorite countries in the world where my family has land and a farm, and the landscape 20 years ago looked very different than it does now. Now it's littered with large windmills. And I know this is very different than what we're talking about, but it has destroyed the view shed from across the river or from driving down the road or whatever it is. And I saw the same thing in parts of California. And when I see something that you build, and I'm not comparing a house to a windmill, but I'm trying to just get to the point of when I see what you build, it feels like it belongs there. It feels as if it's been there. Tell us that approach, how you get there, how you think about that, and why it's so important.
Well, Mark, you're making a really important point. You started off with a comment that's particularly important to us here in the office when you talk about larger projects. Probably about 50% of our work is in the residential arena, and then another 50% is in other arenas, which largely mean larger buildings, buildings more in the public realm. And what we've noticed is that unless the architects have an understanding of what it feels like to be in scale, if that makes sense, in scale of what it is to be a human. In other words, how much room do we need between each other? How do we flow between each other? At its root, that's the residential arena, the home, the most important place in our lives, which is the home. And what's the scale of the home? Do you feel comfortable at the dining room table? Do you feel comfortable standing up and walking around? If you're in a refuge part of the house, how does a refuge work? If you're in a prospect part of the house, how does that work? As it's not our term, it's an old term, an old architectural term, but it's about the cave and the meadow, prospect and refuge. We need both those kind of extremes in anything that makes sense to us in our sort of human evolution, if that makes sense. And because we worked so deeply in the residential arena, we have a natural instinctual sense of what it means to be in a place of refuge and of intimacy and of the place and the culture and the landscape, if that makes sense. You're spot on about that. And we try to bring that sensibility to the larger buildings, whatever those buildings might be, so sure. that there is a sense of the hand, the body, and how we move in those spaces.
Yeah, and another thing I'd point out that I find fascinating about your designs, and I see other great architects doing similar work now, you are leaders in this, is just how you integrate the indoor with the outdoor experience, mm-hmm. and whether it's using certain types of windows and doors, but how the different levels and grades flow to outdoors and so on. And it tends to be much more enjoyable with certain climates than others, or certain times of year in other climates than others. But the ones that I've been able to enjoy and experience, you seem so good at that. So, it takes a lot to get there. And so tell us, what are your favorite phases of design and construction when you're working on these large projects and trying to achieve these sort of integrated indoor-outdoor feels and then also making sure that you're one with the landscape?
Well, honestly, we love all phases. And in fact, we actually make a point in our office that everybody works on early conceptual phasing all the way through the technical delivery of these projects, because Mark, you're right. At some point, the decisions you're making at the concept level have everything to do with how you deliver an actual building on the site. And that means working with the fabricators, working with the contractors, and working with the clients yourself, and beginning to early understand what are what's the context, what's the landscape, what's the client, and beginning to sort of develop an idea that engages that place. Now, I will say there's something that's kind of interesting in any sort of residential scaled place, a place that you feel, and we were implying this earlier, a place you feel really protected, safe, in a refuge, but also has the ability to sort of open up to that landscape, because we need both. We need both the adventure and we need both the intimacy, the safety. And what we've been working on over the years are buildings that, in a sense, break down that barrier between the outside and the inside. So you really feel like you can move inside the outside. I grew up in a mid-century culture, and my problem always with mid-century homes was there was a sheet of glass mm-hmm. between the exterior and the interior and vice versa. And I always thought it was like a broken promise. It implied there was this sort of transparency between the inside and the outside, but there wasn't actually. You had to go over to a little mean door to go outside. Now, what we're trying to do with you all is actually break down almost like layers of clothing, if that makes sense.
That's right.
So if you're in Etna or if you're in the Grand Bahamas, those are two different places of clothing layers, if that makes sense. So how sure. do you design a building that allows the owner to choreograph their own experience? Whether it's a sort of an intimate refuge experience, if there's challenging weather outside, or if it's just perfect, how do you sort of open the doors and the windows to that landscape and experience it at its sort of best level?
You know what's neat about that, though, is I've become a deeper follower of architecture, and yours in particular, is I've seen some incredible things. I think it's in the Berkshires and or the Adirondacks and other areas like that. And those are going to be much colder environments. They get shorter periods of warm weather, but you've managed to figure out how to create the connection with closed windows, with closed doors, so that the experience from indoor to outdoor. And I think that matters to our people who will listen to this or be interested in doing a project in the Boston area or somewhere north in Maine or in north, Washington State, like up where you've done some amazing projects. The weather is just not as mild and not as easy to work with as it's going to be in the South. And I admire how you've managed to work those together and figure out how to use that glass There is a barrier, but it feels as one when you're traveling through those spaces or living in those spaces, even in the colder months. So kudos to you on that.
Yeah, it's beautiful and it's seamless and it's fun to watch it take shape as we are in our Napa and our Grand Bahama projects, as we see the design evolve to its final state. It's pretty fascinating to participate in those conversations with Tom and Kevin's team and to hear all the different discussion points about what should be moved, where should this wall go, where should the door be, how does it flow the view with the view shed. And it's really just an incredible conversation to be a part of. So Tom, I want to ask you one more kind of philosophical question. I want to ask Kevin a couple specifics about a couple of the jobs that he's working on. So, you know, Tom, I've heard you speak in the past about the difficulty and importance of residential design versus larger commercial projects. Could you elaborate on that? That's fascinating to us. I mean, we've done mega projects and we're working on others, but we're now focused very heavily on branded residential as a core of our business. And so I thought it was very interesting. So I'd like to hear your take on that.
Yeah. You know, I'll quote an architect that we have a particularly large respect for, Glenn Murcutt out of Australia. My wife and I were privileged to spend a day with Glenn down in Australia. And as most of you know, Glenn won the Pritzker Prize, really based on residential architecture and his influence, both in the residential arena and the commercial arena, the larger building arena, has been immense. But it's always based on these sort of small scale projects. And he said something that was really interesting. He said that the residential architecture is the architecture that the business of architects have forgotten. And what he meant, and at the obviously at the detriment of some of the work that we do as architects. And what he meant by that was, at its base, at its root, residential architecture is all about being human. Food, water, shelter. Shelter is the most, you know, one of the three essentials for us to survive. And so at its root, at our sort of evolutionary root, we are about shelter. And that means scale. That means all this history of how we developed to protect ourselves. We're actually pretty weak animals, if you think about it. We need a shelter. Oh, yeah. We need a shell around us for all sorts of reasons. And if you do work in the residential arena, you understand those sort of spaces and scales and flows intimately. And it just becomes an instinct as a designer, because so much of our work is actually instinctual or intuitive. So when you take those experiences to the larger scale, you're bringing those ideas to the larger scale. So you're understanding what it's like to be in that space. And that's very, mm-hmm. really important. It's human centric, it's human central. And that's what we try to do with all our larger scale project. And of course, we're doing more and more of the larger scale project, but we're still firmly in the residential arena. And we will continue to embrace the residential arena at all levels. So hopefully that makes some sense, but it's all Absolutely. About experience. It's all about wisdom. And it all leads to an intuitive idea. It's like a bag of tools, right? You have these tools, and you know, Weller and Sixth Senses come to us and ask us to engage a particular place in a particular program. Well, we take those tools, those instincts, those intuitions, and we make places that are human central. Hopefully that makes some sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think this is directed a little more towards Kevin than I wanted to bring up and just kind of, you know, get his thoughts on this. Let's switch over just for a minute from residential over to the more commercial end of things, like a high-end hotel. Maybe it's a low-key count. Some of the stuff we're doing, low slung, human scale. But there's this B word, right? And the B word is budget, right? And budget and beautiful architecture don't always fit together. And I think when you're dealing with the homes at the level you're dealing with at, I think you can spend more on a per square foot basis or whatever it takes. when you start getting into a commercial application, it requires a lot of collaboration on the finish side, on the structure side, on the roof pitches. I mean, I could give you 50 different areas where you can cut little things to try and save a dollar, but try and keep the design integrity. And what we have found so challenging just in general, and we find you all to be excellent collaborators. I've worked with some incredible collaborators on some great projects as well. And what we find most challenging on every project, and I know you do as well, is how do you meet the design integrity when you're working on a commercial project, but still meet the budget? So how do you still keep the fabric and the layering and all of the important factors that come with the design of the project, but keep it on budget, in line with what a developer needs to in order to make it profitable, so that it's a sustainable project long term. What are your thoughts on that, and how do you go through that process?
Well, some of it relates back to what we've been talking about: the site, the landscape, and the connection to it, and creating an experience for the guest or the inhabitants that really raises your awareness of those surroundings and celebrates it. So, for example, you have a wall of glass facing a very special view. There's an investment of dollars. The dollars are focused there. But the rest of the room, the rest of the spaces can be simple. In fact, they should be simple, because to do otherwise is going to take away from your enjoyment of this place and that moment. So I think it's a discipline. Many architects, I think, avoid the discussion of cost. We just consider it part of the design dialogue. It's like literally you're talking about these big ideas about the landscape and the humanity, and then all of a sudden you're like, we should focus the dollars here to assure this. And you'd have to keep coming back to it, which is sort of my job in all of this, is sort of the steward of the design intent, the thing that we come up with together at the beginning with you guys and Six Senses, that Tom is leading. We got to keep coming back to that all the way through the process. And we got to keep going. Are we still meeting the design intent? Are we on budget? Yes, let's proceed forward. So,
and it's not an easy task, by the way. And I commend you all for being a firm that's able to do that. I have other great friends I've worked with who have been very similar. And quite frankly, we found other firms that it was very difficult to get there. So I commend you for being flexible and always looking for that way to achieve that. And that was a great description of how to achieve it. And obviously it's necessary on these commercial projects. So I think for any commercial developer out there listening to this, you know, when you call this firm, you're going to get that opportunity to deliver the project you need to, that fits the budget you need to from a commercial standpoint.
Absolutely. Kevin, let's keep going in that direction, if you don't mind, for a minute. Talk about how you and Tom manage a project like ours. Like, how do you bifurcate your time? How do you divide responsibilities? Like, how does that work? And then I want to get into, after that, I want to talk a little bit specifically about each project.
Absolutely. As I was mentioning earlier, the idea of sort of being the steward at the detail level. So that's kind of what I do. Watch out for the design intent. Continue to ask those questions of the team and each other to kind of keep us moving forward and focused. And then we're, of course, all the way through the process, constantly pulling Tom back into it. But, you know, for every three or four design meetings a team might have, Tom's going to be in two of them, or maybe one, and we're going to keep things moving along, and we're going to keep it on track. And the other thing, I mean, as kind of a side note, but this is along with budget as well as this, the idea of the different phases. You know, the conceptual phase, super fun. The building, super fun. The in-between is a lot of hard work. And that's the part where you can overcomplicate. You know, you can hit your SDDD budgets, and all of a sudden you get into construction documents and you're drawing all these details. And you have to keep an eye on the younger architects. And one of the phrases that we use a lot here, and I think Tom coined this initially, was looking at a detail and you're looking at it going, oh my God, this is complex. And you're thinking, why did they, this is not, it's so complex. It's taking away from the big idea. And so what he'll ask and what we all ask is, well, what would a farmer do? What would a rancher do? Why are you doing more? You know, why? There's a beauty in the simplicity here that is going to reinforce what you're trying to do. So let's just simplify that. Does that make sense? You
guys? That's a fantastic answer, Mark. It's kind of like our main thing the main thing. Keep the main thing the main thing.
Yeah. Well, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing, but it's also key. There's another one that I was thinking of that's much simpler, which is keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah.
Because like, but that's so, it's so good though. I think I'm going to switch that over to what would the rancher do? What would
the farmer do? Incredible.
Sounds a little nicer. Yeah. Write that down.
That's going to have to be the title of the podcast, I think.
That's great, guys. Thanks for sharing that.
So Kevin, could you go into a little bit of detail on the Grand Bahama project first and then Napa, and just give us an observation or two about the design, the landscape, or anything that you find noteworthy?
Well, I think it's, as I mentioned earlier, having personally never been to the Caribbean, but having always wanted to go, my first impressions of the place are, it's surreal. It's otherworldly. The various colors of blue in the water and the white of the sand, and then just the warmth and embrace of the people there. Incredible. Getting to the site at first, it's overgrown with an invasive. We learned this on site with one of the specialists that you guys brought to the site. An invasive evergreen that actually ruins the soils for all the indigenous plants. So that's step one, is to take that away. And there were some moments on the site that had been damaged or changed through the storms, which are obviously quite frequent there. So I guess what I would say is you guys went down there and you saw the possibilities. And that's amazing. You're able to think beyond what you're seeing there. And then you're able to reach out to big thinkers like Six Senses and all the other great folks on the team. And so I think for us, then it's about thinking about, you know, what was there? What was some of the vernacular indigenous responses? How did they build to, again, go back to what Tom said earlier, create the shelter we need? There's a lot of answers in just looking at what people did to survive in a place that inform what we should be doing now. So that's, I mean, it's a very special place. It's really about that connection to the ocean, but it's not like anywhere else. It's not like Hawaii or other tropical places, which we've built in. So it's a super privilege to go along on this journey with you guys.
Well, thanks for that. And I agree with everything you said. And we could talk about that for an hour just alone. but we don't have time for that. So I'm going to shift away from Grand Bahama quickly and tell us about your thoughts on Napa. Obviously, it's in the Pope Valley in Napa County, the old Etna Springs Resort. So tell us about your thoughts on that project.
Well, this has many dimensions, additional dimensions, the dimensions of time, story, the sort of meaning to this community and this place, and then the histories of sort of energy that's been invested by guests that have come here to heal, to gather, enjoy a round of golf with, you know, to spend time with their family. That's all there, but it's been left to kind of to fall away. And so our task here, and by our, I mean you guys and us and everyone involved in it, is to look at what it was, but to think about what it could be, to be good stewards, but to create a new chapter in an unfinished story, one that is going to continue to give back to people that come to Six Senses in new and unexpected ways.
It's really interesting when you look at the two projects. You talked about view sheds and the landscape in Grand Bahama. And that presents, unique conversations and design, decisions. with view sheds out to the canal on one side on the north, and then view sheds out to the ocean on the other. And obviously there's, you know, raising of the site and raising of the structures and building a berm and all these things to protect from future storms. And then conversely, you layer on the Napa project, which is a totally different environment, you know, mountainous in nature, houses on lots that are, you know, 30 to 100 acres, and for all intents and purposes, built on huge hills or very close to huge hills. So it's just, give me a moment on that. Just, it's fascinating to see the difference of the two different landscapes and how your team works through the views and the outdoor spaces, you know, based on those. I know we've touched on it a little bit, but it's just fascinating.
Well, I think the other thing that's interesting about Etna is there's an agrarian history there. There are ranches and vineyards. And
yes.
So when we ask that question, what would a farmer or rancher do? We just have to kind of look around to see it. And in Bahamas, I think it's also similar. As you have, you know, at the minute we set foot in a place, we're looking at how people are living. You know, we visited a home that was on a canal, and we had a party there with you guys and local Bahamians, and experienced some of their traditions. And that kind of immersion and engagement with people, that's what Sixth Sense is doing. That's what they're all about. We don't want people to go away from these projects and go, that was really cool architecture. That's not the right intent. You know, it's not what people are going to remember. They're going to remember the things I'll remember for a lifetime are the way they sat in a certain place and watched the sunset and had a moment, had a glass of wine. So I think that's really what it's about. And that circles, you know, full circle back to humans, you know, versus the designer's ego, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
You know, if I could just jump in and just give you a personal experience. The question is actually a good one. We cannot design anything without first walking the site. And we walk it for quite a while and go back to it a number of times because it's amazing to discover the nuances of a site. And
even, you know, seasonally.
You know, 100%, 100%. Yeah. Seasonal, super important. And the other is, I think it's really important for what you're doing at the site. It's the journey to get to the site too. You know, in Etna in particular, the road trip to get to that Etna site, I think is really fantastic. Beautiful. Through that landscape. And you pull into the Etna, into the Etna site, and you have in a way been introduced with the road trip to that site. And here's a special moment at the end. It's the journey. And it's now your Sixth Senses experience starts in a place, but in the process of getting to that place, it was an adventure.
Totally.
Which I think is 100%.
Totally. And it's like, it's all about that sequencing. And then many 100%. Times it's unintentional, but you get there and then you've arrived and then the story really begins, right? The story is building up, it's building up and it begins. Now that's incredible. And, you know, and while we're on environmental sustainability, that's obviously a huge focus of ours. And it's a big deal. It has been for a while in many design firms and so on. But, you know, talk about how you address sustainability in your projects, in particular in our projects that vary so differently with different issues, but still, you know, still similar issues in a way. Tell us about how you're approaching those and thinking about those from that perspective.
Well, it's, you know, there's very many dials to turn to make a project sustainable. And each of our sites and our projects that we're doing together, the two of them have, you know, a lot of different dials to turn. And so there's the basic philosophies that we have of orientation, dealing with the sun, overhangs, protecting from the weather, those sorts of things that are just, you know, inherent in the work that we do, as well as building to last. You know, we want to create something that is going to stand the test of time, as do you guys, and not be a fad, not be temporary, so that you're tearing down all that embodied energy and replacing it with another temporary structure in the future. So big picture, philosophically, that's how we're approaching it. But you know, Grand Bahamas, we're looking at cladding materials that, you know, Kebni, for example, is a softwood grown in Scandinavia, a softwood that grows fast, and then they put it through a process that they pressure cook it essentially and change it at a molecular level to have the density of a hardwood teak or something from the rainforest. So we look for little opportunities like that.
Which gives it more resiliency with, mm-hmm. with the moisture or, exactly. or storms and things like that. Understood. Yep.
Absolutely. And you don't have to refinish it. You just let it weather.
Wow.
It's done.
Yeah.
You know? So
yeah.
Those are the sorts of things that we're looking for in terms of the materials we pick.
What's a good example of like a Napa? You know, we have wildfire issues in places like Northern California. You have just all kinds of different things going on out there, right? So what are other ideas you have around being environmentally sort of thoughtful and sustainability in that environment?
Well, a lot of the same stories. The other interesting thing about Napa is you're reusing historic buildings.
Yeah.
And that's sustainable. Adaptive reuse, remodeling. I mean, initially we were only helping you guys with the new architecture. And now we're helping you with the new and the old. And we're equally excited about both. We might even be a little more excited about the old architecture and the adaptive reuse and the remodels. Because I think that is very sustainable, and you get those layers of meaning and time. And well, Tom and I have both had our opportunities of restoring old bungalows, so as a hobby. So I think that interest is there. The fires are obviously a real issue, and we have to think about using materials cited in the right way to, you know, mitigate for that danger, while at the same time creating something that people are going to want to hang out in and enjoy.
Yeah, exactly. Now this is going to be a tough one. We always ask questions like this and they're really tough, but when Tom, I'll let you kind of take the lead on this, and Kevin can jump in where he needs to. But you know, when you look back at your career, you know, and I'm not going to say we always ask, what's your favorite thing you ever did? I never liked that. That's not fair, because people who do a lot of things, they have a lot of favorite things, right? But what has been sort of the most pivotal or impactful project, you know, and how did it change things for the firm, or how did it change things for you and how you look at things, or, you know, what was one of those real big moments, and what was one of those real big projects that you did?
Okay. I'm going to not answer your question from a project standpoint, because that's so, like, obviously that's super dangerous. But I do get that question asked quite a bit, and there are some pivotal projects, and it's kind of interesting to sort of think about them. But honestly, Mark, if I'm thinking about the pivot happened at some point in my career in my 30s, where I understood that the architecture that really appeals to me is an architecture of adventure, if that makes sense.
Oh,
and therefore,
yeah.
my career is an adventure. And that's why what you guys are doing is so appealing to me, because I do think I'm so privileged to be involved in this adventure of different places, different climates, different clients, different situations. Couldn't be more excited about what we get to work on, because it's like an adventure. And what could be better about that? So I'm not really answering your question in terms of architecture.
No, you didn't even come close. Like, you didn't even come close.
I like the honesty, though.
No, I like the honesty. Hey, look, it's a tough question, and we ask those. But look, I think you're right, and I think at some point throughout this, that's what happened. I was about to start hysterically laughing, because I feel the exact same way about my own career and my own adventure, because it's clearly an adventure going from wherever we all started to wherever we're all at now, no matter what we're doing with our careers and our lives. And in this case of what you and I are doing, it actually feels like an actual adventure, something like
yeah, it does.
Some days I'm in a four-wheel drive driving to the top of a mountain worried about rattlesnakes. So yeah, it feels like an adventure. You know, and so I'm going to ask one more follow-up question for you. And again, you don't have to do this towards a project either, but you know, what do you hope to be? And this could go for both of you too. And I'll ask Kevin first and then Tom, but I'd like you both to answer this because this really matters. What do you hope to be remembered for? And you know, what do you want your professional legacy, you know, outside of your families and outside of your friends and all of those relationships, what do you want to be remembered for professionally?
This is a really good question. I'm thinking back to an artist that came in and spoke to us about his art, and he had grown up in a Bruce Goff house. And all of his art and all the work he does and all the energy in his life that he puts forward was all inspired by that Bruce Goff house and growing up in it. And so I think, you know, we have a lot of responsibility to be thinking about what we're creating for people to inhabit. And what I'm hoping people will remember, and I think actually it probably would be better to say hope what people will continue to discover is the little moments in each of the projects that I've worked on that I thought about. And that's what I look for out in the world when I go someplace and there's just a beautiful placement of a door handle that has this really nice motion and this patina over time. And an architect thought about that, which is on the flip side, you know, that's not as prevalent as you'd hope it would be. Mm-hmm. But those little details, you know, there's the wow when you move in initially, but you know, it's 3 years later when you're still discovering things about the projects. That's what I'd like to be remembered for.
That's awesome. That's all.
Yeah, you know,
and you're batting Kevin cleanup. You're batting cleanup, Tom. So yeah.
That's all right, because Kevin is that we're very parallel in this. Is that I see us as just a link in a long line of ancestors and future architects to basically evolve and improve our delivery of placemaking and of making places really special. Here's something I really want to emphasize. One of the reasons, and particularly in the Aetna project, we are in a conversation with an earlier architect on that site, which I find completely fascinating, because the work of that architect on a number of buildings is really very special. And that may not be apparent to people that come initially, but the work that we do, the work that architect did, will grow better with time. And it's, Kevin said 3 years. I'm hoping it's 10 years, 100 years, that as people experience these buildings, they don't need to know who the architect is, but the building gets better with time. And that speaks to timelessness, but it also speaks to the nuances of architecture that are ultimately, as Kevin said, almost more important than the concept. It's how do you feel? How does it move? How do you touch it? Which I think ultimately are what architecture is all about.
That's awesome. That's a great answer. Thank you.
Yeah, those are two really, really great answers. And I think great ones to end on too. I know we want to be respectful.
By the way, Matt, just for the record, if he said that 20 years ago, I would have had no idea what he said.
I know, me too.
So, but no, I think
no
I
doubt.
What he
no
said.
Doubt.
Okay, I think
exactly.
I got it now.
Yeah.
You thought it was BS. I know.
I came a long way. I'm just feeling good about my own personal growth over the past from 32 Mark, to 52.
Yeah, Mark, I've actually said this in like AIA kind of conventions, and boy, do I get a lot of awkward. Uncomfortable comments. I say you shouldn't be able to submit your design for an award until it's 10 years old, because after 10 years, you understand, is it aging gracefully? Is it actually better than it was when you
totally.
started? Because architecture is about 100 years, 200 yeah. years.
No, that's incredible.
Yeah, I'm just so glad we had a chance to catch up on this. I don't know if you guys, Tom and Mark, if you knew this, but it took us about a year to get this scheduled because you and Tom and Kevin are so busy traveling all over the world. I'm so thankful that we got a chance to finally have this conversation. I think our listeners are going to really love it, and it's going to be really interesting to them. So I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules to come on.
Well, thank you. This is a big deal for us to get our message out.
Yeah, what an awesome conversation. It was an honor to have you today. It's lots of fun. I hope we have 20 more projects together, and I know we're going to have more than just the two we're doing together. And we're going to continue to work in beautiful places and do beautiful designs together and hopefully make the world a more beautiful place. So thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you, guys.
We look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. A big thank you to Tom Kundig and Kevin Kudo King for being with us today. If this episode was of interest to you, definitely check them out on olsonkundig.com and at olsonkundig on Instagram. As always, we'd love to hear from the audience, so hit us up on social media at Weller Development on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Rienzo, and he's Mark Weller. Keep building, people.